And we're back. Welcome to No Direction Beyond, your Starfinder news, reviews, and interviews podcast. I'm Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param, and I'm joined by
Alexander Agunis, the Everyman Gamer.
And I'm James. I write Code Switch.
Excellent. Today is a very awesome episode because we get to do our second review. More specifically, we get to complete the review of Starfinder the Entire System by reviewing the Alien Archive.
Oh, you cheater. You have it?
Yeah,
you actually have the print copy?
Yes.
I love the print copy. I didn't pre-order mine until after Gen Con, and I was literally shipped like last week. I still don't have mine.
They shipped this out crazy early to subscribers and pre-orders, man. Like, mine came weeks ago. It's been a really fun read, too. We're going to have a lot of fun talking about this book, but I do want to acknowledge...
Wait, hold that up again. Hold it up again. One more time. So, no, sideways.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that, too.
Yeah, that was the first thing I noticed when you put it down. Like, whoa.
Yeah.
That's like a lot about this book. That's like a my-sized book.
Because this is a very significant book, both in Starfinder's life and in Pathfinder and Paizo's publishing's philosophy going forward. A lot of assumed rules have changed with this book. But before we get into that, I want to acknowledge that this might not be how you usually notice us on our presentation if you're watching us on YouTube or on Twitch. We have this episode coming in really hot because it seems just about every piece of technology that could have broken broke. Yet we somehow made it live on time. So please forgive any visual nonsense that you're going to see here. We're doing our best on this one, and we will try to get all these things banged out by the next time you watch a No Direction show. But in the meantime, let's get started on this book. Okay, full disclaimers, does anybody work on this book? I have to ask this
Nope.
every time. Okay, good.
No.
Nobody on this show right now has words in this book.
I mean, like, I got the basic idea for the monster construction stuff as part of working on the core rulebook and, like, getting that together. So, like, I had an idea of what was coming, but I didn't have any stat blocks. I didn't know how they're going to have a list of monsters. I didn't know anything about this one going.
Right. Until you guys were flipping through the PDF, you'd never seen the final of this.
But I do use similar words like the one, you know, a lot of the same vocabulary.
Aslanti, I use that word a lot.
So now I have to add that to that disclaimers too. Started FCC!
Disclaimer, the host often used words that appear in the book in everyday conversation.
Yeah. Okay, so other things to talk about. We are filming this live in front of a Twitch audience. So if you are on Twitch, please get us those questions into chat. If you have any questions about this book, about the show, about what we think about anything, get them into the Twitch chat. We will be answering them throughout the show. Okay.
Indeed.
So let's just go over the core stats of this book. This is the first book full of monsters for Starfinder, the role-playing game. It clocks in at 160 pages if you count the back ad as a page.
It is tiny.
It is a hardback. It is $39.99 US. It has, let me see here, 80. It says more than 80 critters in here, and 20 of them are playable as player.
Jeez, Param, are you going to tell us the exact like millimeter width of the paper while you're at it?
Well, please do. It looks like it.
No, I was joking. Stop. No, let's just move on and talk about monsters.
Okay, but I'm pretty sure it's 30 weight high gloss.
Why would you do that? Why would you know that?
Because
I'm a publisher and I don't know that.
Do a lot of print work.
I see 22 asterisks in the table of index there for playable character racial traits.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So let me tell you, that's like one of my favorite new features in this book. The fact that like Paizo books always list the monsters in the beginning, but this time they go really out of their way to say, hey, these are the ones you can play. They have little asterisks next to all.
In fact, the presentation of this book is above what we're used to from
the
monster book. There's a lot of iconography. It follows a lot of the design trends that we saw in the Starfinder core rulebook. So they're taking a lot of the stuff that you start to see them flesh out in the beginner's box and then the RPG strategy guide, and then they put that all through the Starfinder core rulebook, and of course they also put them in this book.
So another thing if you don't know, iconography means using little pictures to, you know, convey information about the overall presentation of something in a book. And the interesting thing about Alien Archive is that while it is new, it's also, in a sense, predictable, and it's very much something that you could have guessed if you've been looking at other books coming through Paizo's... what's a good way to put it? Paizo's pipeline. That's a great way of putting it. Thank you, James. Like, for a great example is the book uses little icons to tell you whether the monster is primarily a skill-focused critter, a spellcasting critter, or a... They call it combatant. I'm going to call them warrior critters. Just because I think that saying... like, I feel like anybody who's in a combat is a combatant. I don't like that one choice of words. I would have preferred like warrior or pretty much anything else. Yeah. But regardless, they have these little pictures that go with them. So whenever you get to a page, it very clearly tells you like what this monster's role in a battle is just with the picture. And these pictures appeared in the core rulebook when they were giving the sample stat block with the hilarious CR20 goblin. Mm-hmm. They're also in First Contact. So if you've been paying attention to how they've set things up, it's very predictable, but where First Contact has a very Pathfinder bestiary look to it, like the Alien Archive very clearly builds off of Starfinder Core Rulebook's presentation.
There's also something very subtle they did with the layout that I want to call out as being awesome that you might not have noticed being useful just looking at the PDFs. But up in the upper left-hand corner, they have a close-up picture of the critter, as well as its name, which makes...
Isn't that the right-hand corner?
Right-hand corner. Which makes it silly easy to just flip through and find what you're looking for.
What did you think about the presentation, James?
I mean, that's good, because because if you're looking at a PDF one page at a time, monster entries will go through pages. So at least when you're going through, you can see, oh, I'm still on this page talking about this.
So I think that's a very... You touched on something that's very different from Alien Archive compared to Pathfinder Bestiaries. In Pathfinder, with the exception of Bestiary 6, it's very uncommon for a monster to have more than one page in their entry. But that's not the case in Alien Archive.
No, every single critter in this book has a two-page spread. Mm-hmm. The stat block is on the left, and then the bonus information as well as the flavor text, it goes through the right page.
And calling it bonus information is pretty good, because for the majority of the critters in this book, in addition to getting the critter stat block and the art and a little bit of information about the monster, like, there's content, like player content in some cases in this book. It's really like, whoa, this is next gen level stuff, man. If you're a player and you thought you could skip Alien Archive because it didn't have any content for you, oh man, you're wrong.
No, it fills in some gaps too. A big one that I've seen is people complaining there's not a variety of sniper rifles. They're included in some of the racial entries. More stat blocks.
Not just included. This more than doubles the amount of player available sniper rifles.
Yeah, I mean, like doubling 4 to 8, you know, but.
Well, I mean, but like there's like new types of power, heavy armors, there's magic items, there's races. The book has the entire line of summon monster spells in it. Like the level of stuff in this book is crazy, and I think it's really smart. Is this something you guys want to talk about now, or should we wait till later?
I think we should go ahead and talk about it since we're already on it. I went ahead and did a little bit of a sort of a count, and it turns out about a third of this book is player content,
which is really smart. And I'm going to tell you why as a publisher. When you are putting out a book that is primarily designed to appeal to the GM, you're like, theoretically, if five people are needed to play a game, then you are selling your book to one-fifth of the population, because not only are the other people at the table not necessarily interested in your book unless they decide to pick up the mantle of GM, but many GMs actively discourage players from owning bestiaries, if only because they don't want the players to be sneaky and looking at stat blocks and trying to figure out monsters in the middle of the game. But this book is like, oh no, this book is for you too, players. Sure, we're mostly stat blocks and monster creation rules for GMs, but we also have all of this stuff that's custom and unique and cool that you guys can buy or purchase or build or take. Why don't you come on down and play with us? And I think it's a very smart move for a game system that very clearly has a slower release pattern penned compared to Pathfinder, because that way every book is potentially tapping into the entirety of the Starfinder audience. So I would not be surprised if this philosophy is brought into more and more of the Pathfinder core rule books. Like, if we get a Bestiary 7 somewhere down the line, it would not surprise me.
And traditional publishing rules usually said that it was okay to release GM books because it only sells to one of the group, but it's the one of the group that buys the most books, traditionally, when you study the spending habits. But I know what audience they had in mind here, and it's the same reason the very first Starfinder Society boon requires you to get the Adventure Path volume. This is aimed at the Starfinder Society player as far as the player content is concerned.
I think that's a fair assessment. I'm sure that if you play Starfinder, it's like, oh, I'm upset that they're making this book, but at the same time, it's kind of neat to have a book come out already that gives you more options in society.
And it's just the kind of
stuff.
Sorry.
Well, what do you think, James?
Well, you're going to probably see more things, assuming that this book is sanctioned for society, which it'd be weird if it wasn't.
Seeing what really
content
weird.
Is and isn't. The noirs have this really weird way of mixing weapons or items together.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to know if that was legal. So we'll see if there's we already have the FAQ board there, but see if that gets bigger or if they just blanket rules.
And that's a talk I want to get into afterwards, but I think we need to establish what this book is a little bit more before we start getting into inside baseball about what is or isn't going to be legal in society play.
Yeah.
Do so much society.
So, Param and James were saying, there's a substantial number of things that are just it's roughly one out of every two is a player race, or one out of every three, I should say, is a player race, which is pretty cool and pretty different. And I don't know about you guys, but I remember way back when Starfinder had been announced, Eric Mona made this big statement where he was like, and you'll get to be the alien, you'll be the weird thing. And I don't know if I actually believed him when he said it. Man, oh man, does this book deliver on you can play the weird thing. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, it's what, the third, fourth? Is it the fourth? Let me find him. No, fourth, fifth. It's right in the early A's.
My favorite is
Disco.
The Banthian.
That one is awesome. My favorite is the balloon bugs from First Contact.
Totally bring those guys up.
Not only are they playable, but there's this hilarious picture where I don't know how their anatomy works. How on earth the first picture turned into the second picture? But he's literally stuffed in this little suit and it's hilarious. He looks so awesome too. I can't remember what character it is, but I looked at this picture and it immediately made me think of almost a Futurama / Crumboculus Michael look from
the Han, the purple bug that's stuffed into the flight suit.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. He's the best. I love him. He's my new I don't really, but oh man, I don't even know I would want to play the Sheeran over that guy, just because oh man, that bug in that suit is he's best bug. What else can you say?
No, I am down for more monsters in, like, mundane people apparel. Like,
it's great. Oh, and the art from this book borderlines between, like, wonderful and horrifying. Like, there's a piece of art in this book that I was explaining to James why it scared the crap out of me. He was like, oh, that's what's going on? It's the Assembly Ooze?
Oh, my gosh, the Assembly Ooze. If you thought gelatinous cubes were terrifying.
Oh, no. Like, so Assembly, I felt like Assembly Oozes were scary if you were an android, but if you're an android, it's like the most nihilistic monster you could ever fight. Basically, the Assembly uses this monster that looks like a gelatinous cube, but as it moves over technological items, it breaks them down into the, I think they're called UBPs, right?
Yep.
Yeah, that's the picture. That's the horrifying picture, because it breaks down technology into those essential components for crafting, and then it just uses that material to mass produce other things. So if you look at that picture, you have this android who's like screaming, and he's still alive, and like his lower half of his body is probably gone. And then on the other side of the ooze, it's just like pooping out helmets, like these mundane ranking soldier going on some probably first level loser's head helmets. And like, here you have this person who's like slowly watching himself get turned into mundane garbage. It's awful.
Like, if you had to get turned into mundane garbage, what mundane garbage would you choose?
Any type of mundane garbage that didn't require me to be half alive witnessing me turning into mundane garbage, James.
Oh, I'm such a baby. You're already turning into something.
That's the horror of it. Like, turning around and watching your body disappear, and this ooze literally turning stupid. Like,
we've got we've got some good news from chat. WereBuffalo42 says, please rejoice. There is much rejoicing. The Han have already been released as a race boon.
Wow, really? Already?
Well, I guess they were in Alien First Contact, so they had time to take care of that.
Well, yeah, but they didn't have stats in First Contact.
Oh. But yeah, here is the Han as its weird spider puffy thingy. And here he is in a pilot suit.
Yeah, like, I don't know how that guy turned into that guy. That's what I want. They look totally different. Pretty sure that first one is from the Pathfinder timeline artwork. Like, it looks like it might be reused. Like, I want to know how Mr. Bug with, like, just straight appendages got like maneuverable hands. I mean, I guess like there's genetic engineering in Starfinder and stuff, but man, oh man, I want that information. I don't think it was in the book, but it's still super cool. I want to be the super cool bug guy after I play my super cool soldier.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be their Urog.
I really like their special ability too.
The Urog.
Sorry, what's the Urog?
Go ahead, Param. Mm-hmm. No, go ahead, Param. You're good.
I really like their special ability too. They can attach a balloon to you and just as a combat maneuver and just let you float up.
I didn't read that part. Oh my god, it's Metal Gear Solid 5. Oh, yeah, oh, they're going back balloon? To Mother Base.
Extraordinary ability, a Han can create and inflate a web balloon and attach it to an adjacent enemy with a successful melee touch attack against KAC. If it hits, the target immediately rises 30 feet off the ground in a straight line and continues at a speed of 30 feet each round.
That's really funny.
It's just taking away your problems.
Is there anything stopping me from doing it to myself? Like, is it just like self-levitation?
I mean, I don't see any reason why you couldn't.
Do they have a fly speed baseline?
In fact, the art has him attached to several of them.
Yeah. Do they have a fly speed baseline?
I assume that's it.
Then that's probably, they probably don't need it then, just because, yeah, it's kind of pointless to put the balloon, like, actually on yourself if you can just fly, but you probably fly with the balloon. That's great.
If you're lazy.
Yeah. It's important to know that the player race version of it only has slow fall instead of true fly.
Oh, that's okay. Maybe someday they'll make a feat that like lets you get it. Jetpacks are pretty easy to buy in Starfinder. They
and this is
it.
This is a good time to start talking about the structure of what one of the monster articles looks. So we said they were two pages. You've got on your left side, you've got of course the main monster art. There's always two pieces of monster art too. Each monster got two pieces of art, except for the dragon.
Yeah,
the dragon was just a whole bunch of. Like, that was crammed. Okay, so you've got usually one or two different stat blocks for a couple of different versions of the critter, especially if it's a player race version. Mm-hmm. And then you have, like, the normal art over here, and the oddball art is usually on the other side. So this is when we get the Han pilot. And then on the right-hand side is when you get what seemed to be a pattern. You either got the information you needed if they were a player race, Or you got a piece of, and sometimes or and, you would get the cultural equipment, such as like in the first of this book. Let me mark this page. I'm going to come back here because that's going to be the... So you've got like a piece of cultural equipment, like on the very first one, the Aeon Guard. It has like all the stats on the other side for all the equipment that the Aeon Guard use. So you've got their armor and their assault rifles and everything. And then the third type of thing you would get is things like the Crest Eater, which is a horrible, horrible magical beast that is massive in the CR4 here. And it's like things you can craft out of this creature if you kill it.
Yeah.
And it's like those three different types of thing is like what you kept seeing over and over again. That was the pattern for this book.
Yeah, it also looks like ecology has been unified into one style of just environment and organization. Pathfinder has a really consistent ecology where some of it was paragraphs long about their abilities, how they hunt, and some are like lives in groups in a forest. So it's all unified now.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they're asking about it in chat, and you mentioned the ecology. There is like usually a half page minimum to sometimes a full page of fluff that explains like where this monster's from, what's the main thing it does, what their society is like. You get things like it talks about like the history of the Eoxian Necros and how they save their society and how they recreate themselves and how they make the tech phylactery. That's not what they call it. I'll have to get into that specifics.
But usually like one of the pages is crunch and then the other page is fluff. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty good.
And then they kind of like in little tables and sidebars on the fluff page is where they put all the player information, like the player goodies, the reasons that the players would want to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with all your stat modifiers and all that. Yeah, the Urgar, I don't know if you guys remember them. They're like, they look like blue chicken snails, and they have stats for playable race, but they change form between like a weird crystal slug and then this like cockatrice style praying mantis floating thing. But it's, I think that's an awesome race because like you're just going to be a larva that somebody just like you just float around.
Yeah, you start off as this little thing floating around and
little it's still a large creature. Okay. Like the stat block, it is,
but this is cute. This is cute.
What?
And then you have a strange definition
for cute,
which is more cute than the other one. And this could be a Pokemon.
It's kind of like a chocobo. It looks like a chocobo with like a snail. Yeah, like it's cool. It's great.
It's smiling. This is a friendly alien monster.
He's happy.
No friendly aliens. You know, so like, one thing that's interesting about this book, like, if you know where to look, there are a lot of throwbacks to Pathfinder, I would think. Would you guys agree?
Yeah.
So there's actually two I want to look at. Okay. And then I want to just talk about the fact how I'm not crazy that Drow made it in this book. I knew they had to. I would rather just leave Drow in the past and let them have all disappeared on Galarian, personally. But yeah, they're in this book. They have racial stats. You could play Space Dritz if you want to. Okay. But no, actually, I think I know what you think I want to talk about, and I think that if I'm thinking of the thing that you're thinking of, you're wrong.
Okay.
Go
for it.
I want to talk about the Riforians.
Oh yeah, the Riforians.
Yeah.
They're dear to my heart.
The first time, so all three of us hosts have run or played in Reign of Winter.
Hold up. Before we say that, spoiler warning for Reign of Winter.
Okay. Yeah, this is a spoiler warning for Reign of Winter.
Yeah. Way to go, Alex.
Sorry. If you don't want to...
Give another second before Reign of Winter spoilers?
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I don't... It's 3 years old, and it's also in the product blurb of the book, but...
Yeah, but okay. So is another big thing that we don't want to shout out without warning people.
I mean, Snape kills Dumbledore, but I think we're past that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then, if we can be past Snape kills Dumbledore, I think we can be... past the point that Reign of Winter does go to another planet, and you interact heavily with the aliens on that planet, and the aliens bear the same name of that planet. It's one of the planets in the Pact Worlds. Yeah. And so I was actually looking for that race in this book, and it turns out that they got renamed into the future. They are no longer like Earthlings. Like, it would be like if all the aliens called the Galarian people Galarian Knights, I think is the name of the word, right?
Galarian Knights? Yeah, and sure. That works fine if you're the only intelligent species on your planet.
Yeah, but, like, you're not. Like, this race shares its home with another race in this book. Like, a very, very recognizable, very popular race. And so they got an official race name, and so now they're the Riforians, and it's great. I like them. They kind of follow the same trend that Paizo has going with taking, let's say, dimorphic races and allowing you to be more customizable with them than they were in Pathfinder. So, like, famously, the Lashunta used to have one look for men, one look for women, and in the Pathfinder, or the Starfinder core rulebook, that race was changed with technology and modern medicine, all that good stuff, so that you can pick which of those races you are, regardless of your gender. The Riforians are the same. They should always be born Winterborn, but if you are the 1% of Riporians, you can have yourself genetically modified to be Summerborn, even though you're not born in summer. I think that, for me, has interesting context, because the planet that I'm talking about is a planet within a regular orbit, where sometimes it's closer to Galarian and it's summertime and it's warmer, and sometimes it's, or not, it's closer to the sun and it's warmer and it's all melted, and sometimes it's further away. And currently in Pathfinder canon, it's stated to be in the winter form for, like, the next X hundred years. And I think it was an interesting choice to keep the planet at that same general location in Starfinder.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's been more than 500 years, probably. If it hasn't been more than 500 years, that's actually kind of interesting. But I can't help but feel like the choice that the planet, I'm going to go ahead and say it, it's Triaxis, is still in the winter place, whether because it's still there from Pathfinder times or because it's done a complete orbit and X number of cycles and is back in the winter now. I couldn't say, but it's still really, I think it's a really cool and interesting connection. And it makes me wonder if it's something that's going to be explored in the future.
See, that's the real secret. And Triaxis is the clue they're trying to give you. The real secret of the gap is that this is only like 20 years in Pathfinder's future. Happened. And then she did this to the universe in order to make sure that nobody noticed.
Yeah, she just completely rewrote it. I don't know. In my personal theory for it, I don't know whether or not it's true. I don't work for Paizo, disclaimer. I was talking with James about it, and my theory is that something happens during the current AP timeline that makes the gap necessary. Because in all, like, I guess this is kind of a spoiler warning, so I don't think it's my first spoiler for a piece of equipment in one of the AP volumes.
Okay.
I don't think it's a big spoiler, but just in case you do, one of the new pieces of equipment is called a Thrune Blade or something like that. And if you read the description for the Thrune Blade, it makes it very clear that while people remember that it had something to do with some ancient Galarian Empire, they don't remember. And so I'm pretty sure that whatever is happening probably happened around the time where Chelyx took over, and probably involves something Chelyx did that made the entire timeline need to be changed or removed or whatever.
Sure, so, blame the actual devil for having to rewrite all of time.
I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that Asmodeus is not a core deity in Starfleet.
That, like, would be a big deal, like... That is one of the big questions. Like, why? Why isn't he? The Hell Knights are still around.
Yeah. Like,
what happened to Hale?
That's my theory, and I think that there are little pieces. I should do a conspiracy theory after a few books come out.
Oh, but... we can get some, like, weird History Channel music.
ready, James, ready? Devils. Oh, man. Oh, it's...
James wins the podcast. We're done.
Yep. Okay. With that, though, I think going over every single monster that's in this book is a little gratuitous
and exhaustive,
kind of exhausting and not really interesting. But one thing that is really cool about this book that we haven't talked about much is that the layout for how things are presented is a little bit different than in Pathfinder in terms of the actual stat block.
Oh, yes.
I think some choices are good and some choices I don't personally like, but, you know, it is what it is. One of the first ones is that HP is not a line under defenses anymore. It is in the same header line. So it'll be like defenses and then tab over, there's the HP. Hmm. So it's really big and it's really bold and it's really easy to see. I think that is smart.
Yeah, stat blocks as a whole are just smaller in Starfinder, and I appreciate
that. Well, I mean, there's also things that I don't like. One of the things I don't like is that ability modifiers are listed. That's good. That is smart. You know, make it easier for players to use those Starfinder pre-gen sheets. That's cool. One of the things I don't like is that the score itself isn't listed. And for certain ability scores and in certain situations, that's kind of a problem. So, like, if something down the line gives the players the ability to deal ability damage, am I supposed to assume that the monster always has an even ability score and then, oh, well, that's a 3, so it can take 16 points?
Well, I think that's exactly what you're supposed to
do. I mean, it works like with players, where when they have to lose a certain threshold before it matters.
Yeah, but then, like, with Drain, like, for Constitution, it does matter. Strength, yeah. Too, because if you have an odd number of constitution or strength, that one extra point of constitution, that 17 instead of a 16, could be the difference between your monster surviving a poison and dying from poison. For strength, that one extra point of strength gives them an extra bulk they can carry. So I think that that's a particular simplification that I'm not crazy about. One of the things I haven't figured out if I like or not, are made is that monsters don't get feats anymore.
They only get them as special abilities.
Yeah, so like, instead of saying, you have the precise shot feat, it'll say, you have the precise shot special ability, and the text is identical to the precise shot special ability.
Applaud that.
I don't like the idea that monsters are built but using different rules than players. And mostly that's because Pathfinder has this really neat idea that even though like monsters have different special abilities, everybody's playing by the same rules. They're gaining levels and power by the same hit dice mechanics. Starfinder doesn't have that. And I think that there are places where that is hard and confusing. Another good example is that base attack bonus isn't listed. It just gives you an attack bonus, which means I don't know if my CR 1/2 guy who has an attack bonus of 5 has the base attack bonus he needs to pull out a gun while moving, because you need a BAB of +1 to do that.
And yeah,
it's not in the stat
every block. Single character past CR 1.
Yeah, but all the CR1 halves, which you're going to spend your first level of gameplay fighting against, you don't know. So am I supposed to assume that at CR1 combatants can do it, but experts and specialists or spellcasters can't? I mean, that's a fair house rule, I guess, but it's not in the rules anywhere. It's a corner case that I think is made more complicated by the omission.
Yeah. It's a bit weird in society play, especially if you're not... Like, I look through a stat block and I'm like, why is this one attack such a high bonus, and this other one is so ridiculously low? Like, I wasn't sure if it was a typo or not, and I had no way to reverse engineer.
A lot of those were typos, actually. A lot of the ones where they were ridiculously low were typos. That first batch of scenarios, they were being, like, rushed. Like, all of Starfinder we talked about during the review was coming in, like, blazing hot and full of typos. But what everything that Alex just said is absolutely true, but I think the trade-off is so worth it. I think that the reason that they are built under different rules is because most NPCs in any role-playing game exist to do one of two things and then disappear forever. So I don't need to know their exact strength score. I don't need to know their full list of feats. I don't need to know their full list of skills unless it is relevant for the thing they're supposed to be doing. And the feat block especially is something that trips up every newbie GM I ever see, because what happens in the Pathfinder game is they don't list out what those feats do for those characters. You have to look at that stat block, and the feats are the one thing you have to look at, and you have to either know those feats by heart, and those are those experiences experienced GMs do know them most of the time. Or you throw that at a newbie and they get pull their monster out. They think they've got everything they need to play that monster, and then they either play it by the stat block, ignoring the feat section entirely, which includes vital information for how it's supposed to play, or they look at the feat block and go, I have no idea what this thing does. Give me 10 minutes while I look all this stuff up that I was supposed to be able to pull off. Every single monster in Starfinder can be run off the page as is without having to go to look at anything else.
I disagree with that because they still use the universal mechanic, which means that if you don't know an ability, you're still going to have to flip to the back of the book and look. Granted, I will concede that flipping to the back of the book is nowhere near as time-consuming as consorting three different core rulebooks looking for feats. However, I'm less concerned about the feats and more concerned about the omission of base statistics, the ability scores, the base attack bonus. Yeah. I think those are the omissions that are important. Because
the monsters don't even have them. When we're going to go back into the back of the book, you'll see that they don't even have base attack bonus. They just have attack bonus.
You are not wrong. You are right. They do not have it. I'm saying that that is a problem. I'm not saying that it is a feature.
I would kind of concede the opposite. I think it's fine. It's just you have to be careful with typos when you're doing published work because nobody can check your work, so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, the idea with the Alien Archive, you can check the work because one of the things that, and I like this about this book, is that when we start talking about monster creation rules, the monster creation rules are very streamlined. Most monsters of a given CR are going to have the same exact bonuses in the same exact places just because of how that system is working.
Right. It does give you the freedom, and it calls out in the stat block that you're allowed to fudge a little bit to make your monster like you want him to, but it gives you the main ballparks and all the important
numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, so monsters have to kind of say that, and especially with that kind of rule, because monster designing is an art, not a not a science. Right. But I'm going to go ahead and say that based on my intuition as a designer, I'm pretty sure that the game's math assumes that those are the numbers that you have. Straying too far away from them is essentially throwing a higher level CR monster in that one category at your players. I think that while monster building, especially in terms of picking and designing new powers for monsters, is still very much an art, I think that Starfinder moves towards... It takes away a lot of the veil and curtains from the monster building process. It makes it a lot easier and more streamlined, which in the long run means that more people can design monsters, and I think that's a good because I've read tons of articles and tons of blog posts where people or GMs are like, "Oh, I want to do this. Can somebody make this monster for me? I don't know how to do it." And this is definitely not that problem.
Yeah, it's kind of split between stuff like Monster Codex, Core Rulebook, and the Bestiary about where things come from, how you make abilities better. Because this uses a similar style, really similar to Unchained, it's just kind of plug and play. And I was just looking through once real quick. The Combatant is the only one that on a low attack bonus at 1/3 CR has a +1. So if you wanted to house rule that would probably be the only under 1 CR creature that can't draw and move.
Yeah, I mean, I would prefer it to just be about that somewhere, but maybe it's such a small corner case thing that it's not worth it. I feel like we have friends that we game with regular games who would argue against that because it's not in the rules time and time again. I think you know which friend I'm talking about.
Oh, I know a couple, and I tell them all to be quiet.
Yeah, that's the deal. As a GM, you just gotta step up and tell your players to listen. This is the game; don't disrupt it. Since this book very explicitly says NPCs don't play by the rules you're playing by. This is an assumption from 3.x that is fundamentally different. It's one of the very base changes, the biggest changes Starfinder made to the core system. And this is not new. We saw this in Unchained. This is exactly how 4th edition worked. This is how 5th edition currently works. This is how 2nd edition worked before we got to 3rd edition. The fact that monsters played by the same rules as players is something that was unique only to the 3.x version of Dungeons & Dragons and its successors.
Oh, Donato Couch in the chat. Donato Classic, sorry. Regarding the issue on ability scores, if you ever need a monster's exact ability score, assume it has the minimum score it needs to correspond to the modifier.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. That...
So, yeah, I forgot about that part. So, we have
Is that in the book?
It is in the
book. It's in the core rule book.
Huh. Is it in the core rule book or the Alien Archive?
Core rule book.
Core.
Huh. Now, I know that.
Since we were talking about...
I retract my statement then in that one.
No, it's okay. It's a whole core rule book. I had people asking me where page 271 is, because there's only one reference that tells you that when you cast a spell that has a like touch thing that you can hold the charge, because it is mentioned once on one page for a three-sentence paragraph.
Yeah. Ah, I see. And unlike what Parham says, nobody core rule. Listen, Parham, I am still skeptical that you yourself I have not read the entire core rule book. I have skimmed over things that are pertinent to me in my gameplay. I'm sorry. It's true.
Learn it.
I'd say the easiest way to learn it is to play it and reference the book while you're and use what you need. So I don't know about
best way to learn it.
Yes. Mm.
That requires people and time and not cramming for a review and getting ready for Gen Con and.
Everything, Parham. Also, I think you were doing a segue or something.
Yeah, see, I was getting into... Let's talk about how monsters are made in Starfinder, since this finally gives us that section that is not in the core rulebook and completes the Starfinder basic rules.
Fine, but when we're done, we're totally going back, and I'm taking the entire summoning creatures section.
Oh my gosh, summoning creatures is something we need to get into.
So awesome.
It's too bad, but you segued already, and that you...
That can be later. That's later, man. That's later.
Because it's literally the next section of the book.
We're moving along. See how this goes? There would be a nice little fade effect if I was able to do any visual effects right now, but I can't because we're holding this whole stream together with duct tape and chewing gum.
I know, it's great. You can't censor me with visual.
I wasn't supposed to eat that chewing gum?
No. Oh, crap. We're doomed. Okay, so let's go through the how you create a monster in Starfinder. It actually lays it all out on one page. Before you begin, it always says in every monster design book ever, have a concept in mind. And this is super important for Starfinder because that concept is what is going to make your monster not just a pile of the same numbers at the same level that every other monster is. You need to go ahead...
But I like my mathematical blobs.
And before you even start, you pick the CR. And that is like in with Pathfinder. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But in Pathfinder, getting to that CR is something you shoot for during the creation process, and hope you manage to stay within the bounds. It's not something that just starts. I'm at this CR.
I mean, I feel like good designers know what CR they want before they start working. I can't speak for everybody. I always pick a CR before I start, personally, because it's easier to compare to that table's.
You're misunderstanding me. You have a CR you want to get to, but then you have to build into it. The building the monsters in Pathfinder is a lot more variable, and it's more like stacking parts together and making sure that it hits, and then making sure you hit the right numbers you're going for. It's not You don't start at the CR and the CR tells you everything about your critter because you have to still build it up from this is its creature type. It has so many hit dice in this creature type. It has these feats and it has these special abilities that all affect the CR.
Yes, that's true.
Yes, and this works backwards. The CR determines the numbers. So you're always going to hit that CR because you're going to pick it before you even start.
Secondly, yes.
You get the array. And the array is tricky wording. The array is the monster's spine. It's not its statistic array, what we usually talk about. Because you don't know its statistic array, much to Alex's ire.
That's not really my ire, no.
Okay,
and it's really more of a scaffold than a spine, but yes.
Yes.
Yeah. You get all your, like, base numbers, all your basic basis numbers.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, so basically how it works is that you choose your CR first, and that is going to correlate with the numbers that you get, like the level. Your array is like you're kind of more like your role, like you're. It's like, am I a champion? Am I an expert? Am I a spellcaster? And then you basically go to the table in the book that corresponds to your specific role that you picked for your monster, and then you go to the statistic array that aligns with your CR. So like each one has like a table. It goes from like CR 1/3 to CR 20. And like if I'm like, I want to be a CR 5 monster, I go and I want it to be a combatant monster. So I go to the combatant table and I go to the CR 5 line, and all of those numbers are my array.
Yeah, like, and it gives you all your base stuff, your saves, your AC, all your fun stuff.
It gives everything. Oh. It even tells you what your... It's great. And like, hey, if you would be a first level character and you would have one rank, then I guess you have a +8 in that. Like, it just gives you the bonus. It doesn't give you, like, the nuts and the bolts. Like, it gives you what you need to run the monster and not necessarily to build up to it.
Yeah, because the next thing you pick is your monster's role, which is what you're hoping this monster or creature does throughout gameplay. Is this a big combatant that's meant to be up and close and fighting? Is this going to be some sort of specialist that's going to be using the skills or abilities in non-combat situations, or they have a special one out pulled out for? Is this thing going to be a spellcaster? Because if it's a spellcaster, it has its own table.
Yep.
Yeah, all three of them do.
Then you pick your creature's subtype graft. And there's...
Well, no, you pick the type first. You pick type, then subtype.
Okay, yes, you pick your type graft. Tell me what a graft is, Alex.
Okay, so grafts is a concept that was originally chain.
Alex is cutting out.
Am I cutting out? Can you hear me now? Mm-hmm. Can you hear me now? Okay. Yeah. So grafts is a concept that was originally in Pathfinder Unchained. It's basically a list of abilities and or statistics that are associated with a specific kind of creature, whether that it is a subtype like human or a type like humanoid. Another way to think about it, it's kind of like how when you're building monsters in Pathfinder, if you pick to make your monster a devil, there's an entire list of devil traits. Like, the grafts are basically traits from Pathfinder. It's like, but not traits as in, like, player traits, like, traits of a creature. This is a good example as to why the wording should have changed from traits to literally anything else. That word is overused in Pathfinder. Mm-hmm. I digress.
It's a trait of Pathfinder.
No, stop it, my mind, blown! So the basic idea is that your next couple steps, after you pick your CR and determine your role and use that information to get your array, you have to take that scaffold of your creature and fill it out with what kind of creature it is. So you'll go and you'll pull out the list of special abilities for whatever type of creature you want, like dragon or fey or ooze or outsider, and you'll grab the graft that's associated with it. And the word graft literally means to take something and to attach it onto something else, and you're literally attaching these special abilities and universal modifiers and statistics onto your base scaffold. So if I'm going to be a dragon, then dragon has things like dark vision, has things like immunity to paralysis and sleep effects, and I get those abilities and I take them from my creature type graft and I throw them onto my base scaffold that I'm working with. And then once I'm done my creature type graft, I get a subtype graft. So maybe I'm making a humanoid and I'm like, oh man, it's got to be a human. So I go and I grab the human racial traits, and it's literally the same traits from the Starfinder core rulebook, just in graft form. And I take it and I slap it onto my character. Different types of stat blocks have different grafts. A really good example that Param alluded to earlier was that true dragons are basically one dragon statistic and just a list of grafts for every chromatic color. So there's like white dragon grafts, red dragon grafts, black dragon grafts, only the chromatic ones, but they're there in the book. And it's actually pretty easy to make a dragon now. Choose the CR and put the corresponding graft on it, and boom, there's your dragon.
Elementals are a similar way.
Yeah, elementals work the same. Basically, all of those races that were like one type with a billion different fiddly bits, yeah, they like. I'm sure like if they did Mephits would be done the same too. But it's all handled through the graft and subtype graft system. Now, if you're making, go ahead.
James, I want you to help us out here because I'm going to be flipping through the book and Alex is going to be rules encyclopedia. Let's build, or like at least run through building a critter because it's that mm-hmm. easy while we're okay. doing the cast. So pick a CR and a creature type.
Let's go CR4 combatant because that's what I just looked at.
Okay, and what creature type?
Let's go outsider.
An outsider, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
and so, then we go subtype devil. Gimme.
Okay. No, yes. Stay away, Space Chelyx.
More Space Chelyx. Yes. Okay. All right. So if we're going to a combatant, and you said CR4,
yep.
Its EAC is going to be somewhere around 16, or that's on the chart. Its KAC is 18. It's got fortitude to plus 6, reflex plus 6, will plus 3. It's going to have 15 hit points. It's important to also note that monsters usually don't have stamina because they just appear to get killed and be done with.
Usually, yeah. And they also usually don't have resolve, except for certain circumstances, and it's 1/5 of their CR.
So I want to correct both of you since you put me in charge of rules.
Oh, do it, Alex. Do the thing.
Monsters never have stamina. The reason is because stamina is basically a separation for players so that you know when crap has hit the fan, essentially. That's what it's there for. And also so that you can't heal up to your full all the way and resting gives you more hit points. I digress. But at the same time, monsters only have resolve points if they have a class graft, which is the next step that I haven't talked about yet.
Or, according to the book, or a special ability that needs them.
Most of them come from class grafts.
Class grafts is where you get them. But, yeah.
Currently. Not period. Currently.
The ability DC for its abilities is 13. The spell base DC is 11. I guess, you know, not a lot of DC here because it's a beat stick. Its ability score modifier is going to be plus 5, plus 3, plus 1. You would apply those to whatever makes sense. And it's going to have two special abilities. Its master skills are going to have a plus 15 bonus to the skill roll, and its good skills are going to have a plus 10 bonus to those skill rolls when those skills are applicable.
Profession barrister, profession lawyer,
those are the same.
Craft evil spiky tridents.
Mm-hmm.
What if I want craft Voltron?
It's going to have a plus 12 attack bonus, a plus 9 attack bonus if it's inaccurate. If it's doing energy damage, it's going to do a d4 plus 4. If it's doing kinetic damage, it's a d6 plus 4. And the standard damage is going to be a d6 plus 4 plus strength. And then it's not high enough to qualify for having multiple attacks.
That's okay. I couldn't even take one.
So does that mean if it full attacks, it only ever gets one attack?
Doesn't have multiple attacks.
If it had like a multi-attack.
It's capable of doing two attacks by default. The multiple attacks are if it's doing three or four attacks.
Gotcha.
It can use the standard rules to do two attacks, but if it's going to have like five legs and a switchblade on each toe.
All right. Well, why don't you guys quickly pull out the Outsider and the Devil graphs and give them to James quick so we can move on.
All right, the Outsider one has Dark Vision 60. If the Outsider is a member of a specific race like a Devil, they'll have a subtype to match its race. They get a plus 2 bonus to one saving throw, and a Devil you're going to pick Reflex to get out of the way of fireballs, and a plus 1 to attack rolls.
Mm-hmm. And right. For being a Devil... Oh, you already did it. Never mind.
Nope, that was for Outsider. For Devils, they get Sea and Darkness, Immunity, Poison, and Cold, Resistance 10, Acid, and Cold, and gains Immunity to Summon Allies and Telepathy.
Excellent!
All right, we're ready to move on. All right, so the next step in the process is called Class Graph. So if your NPC is someone that has a character, then you can give it a Class Graph. Class Graphs are grant abilities from one of Starfinder's classes based on the relevant class's own class features.
Mm-hmm.
But those abilities are determined by the monster's CR rather than levels class. So if I give you a soldier class graft and you're CR4, then you're going to have level abilities based on the fourth level soldier powers. Mm-hmm. Right. So, James, what class graft do you want?
Oh, let's go mechanic. We're going to give it an exocortex. It's going to be a cyber devil.
Oh, gosh, cyber devil. Oh, right. So
the game talks about hacker devils in here, so
yeah. There's the best devil is spaceship devil.
Yes.
Yeah.
We need to go back to talk about our favorite monsters before we're done this review.
But so anyway, Param, why don't you pull out the mechanic stats for James real quick for a fourth level mechanic?
I have it up.
You have it.
Oh, go ahead, Pam. You got
over
it.
This.
Oh, I thought you had it, Pam. Don't leave me hanging.
You said you had it.
Oh, I trusted you. It's all right. So at CR4, they have artificial intelligence, a custom rig, overload, and 2 second level mechanic tricks that they're able to pick.
Mm-hmm. All right. Write them down, James. Write them down.
The one that you can use computers to faint things, and the one that lets you hack real, real good.
Okay.
That'd be great.
That's great.
All right, so step five is template graft. So if you want your monster to have a template, you pick it at step five. Mm-hmm. So template grafts are basically simple templates from Pathfinder.
Yeah.
There are some exceptions. I think the zombies that are listed in the book are temple grafts as well. Mm-hmm. But generally, it's like things like giant and... my favorite one is they added miniature. It's great. I can make something small without making it a baby. Great, good on you, Paizo.
Excellent.
Now you can
small as a baby.
Exactly. Like you can have small things that aren't babies. So James, what do you want?
Let's make this a nice miniature.
Miniature double.
It's the size of an action figure. I think I just made an action figure.
I don't know if it can be that small, but like, look at the template graph and see what it says.
Let's see. With the miniature, represent a smaller member of your subspecies as shrunk down due to the environment, decreasing its space by one category.
Oh, right. So at what point did we pick the size then?
I don't think we ever did. It's just part of the
concept, because they divorce size from statistics in Starfinder. You can be huge at first level if you want to be.
Sure. Then it was a tiny devil, and now it's diminutive.
Oh God, no! It's an action figure devil.
it's 28 millimeters.
So at
we get to put it on the table and say actual size.
GI devil.
So at step six, you go through special abilities. As part of their array, your creature gets a number of additional powers based on their level. So how many special abilities did our devil get, James?
Two. This is where you get creative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so special abilities can be things like feats. Some of them can be abilities you make up yourself. They can be pretty much anything you want, and you get two of them. They can also be adjustments that switch up their base statistics. Maybe as one of their special ability, they have an extra plus one on their attack rolls. Pretty much whatever you want can go into this category. It also lists that sometimes you can give special abilities free if they're like extra flavorful or whatever. But mostly the ones that they're probably going to be used in combat should be special abilities. They should be counting against your total. So James, what kind of special devils does our miniature devil have?
I mean, I just remember Vortex because I hate all the rules for that, but a cool devil wouldn't do Vortexing.
Oh, do you know what would be really fun? If when he shot somebody with his gun, they had to make a will save or also get smaller. So, dude, any gun that the devil would do it.
I think that would count for two, but how small does it go, Alex? Tell me the limits of this power.
Well, if you leave it like the reduction spell, just one size category.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do it more, it would definitely be two abilities, and you could probably stack it to make them even smaller. I would stack it to let it so that they could just make all of its abilities just be this one shrink ray power. Yeah. Have it be this really annoying devil. It's like, no, it is
down to its size. That's what it needs to do.
It's an imp. It's an imp that wants to bring down mortals to its size.
Oh, I love this devil.
Let's make it let's make it permanent until you kill it.
Make it permanent, period, and like you need like a specific spell to undo it or like a technological item.
I think it'd be funny if it was permanent until you killed it, because this thing would sneak into an office building, shrink an entire middle management bureau, or like accounting. They're just like, we got this devil just in the fence, and it just keeps shrinking Sue from accounting.
Really gonna hurt her. Okay, let's go with that. So the other thing it would need is that, Perim, can you grab the core rulebook and look up the stats on reduced person?
Yes. Ish, no.
Because in addition to we need to know we need to know what happens to the creature as it grows size categories below like small. Like, if it starts out as reduced person, that's fine, but, like, additional hit should shrink you further. Do it also be really funny, James, if when it used its shrink ray, the attack did non-lethal damage?
Until you're its size. So this is where Asmodeus went. He's obviously tiny and just, you know, messing with corporations. Take that, Abadar Corp!
That was great.
I can't find a reduced person.
Glad he found a hobby.
Am I nuts? Is that not in there? All right. So then what we'll do is we'll base it off of Pathfinder then, and we'll go a -2 penalty to things is pretty big in Starfinder. Mm-hmm. So what we'll do is we'll say that it's each size category you go down adjusts your space and your reach as appropriate for your new size, and give it the ability, will save DC from the stat block to resist it. And we'll also say that each size category smaller that the creature gets, it takes a penalty on attack rolls, damage rolls, and on strength checks and strength DCs, and that should be fine. No, because bulk automatically shrink as you get smaller in the core rule.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, so...
But inverse it, they would get half of that back into dex and AC.
Yeah, I don't necessarily know if we want the bonuses from getting smaller. Maybe against...
that's not that devil.
Yeah, anything that's not the devil. I like that.
Because it brings it down to his field of battle, and then they're worthless against anything else.
This is a weird Infernal Challenger spell we've made.
Yeah, it is really weird. I think this would need more development. Get this to be something a little bit better, but for the sake of not spending the entire episode talking about this one shrink devil special ability, mm-hmm. like we'll move on from here.
Right.
So the next part is called
Goodbye Devil.
Yeah. But no,
this is the primary thing you're doing in Starfinder Monsters. It's your special abilities and the concept that defines your monsters, not the core stat lines. Because the core stat lines are all going to be very samey. You're going to make adjustments here and there for your particular critter, but it's these things we're having so much fun talking about. And it's also, this is what our players are going to talk about when they encounter it. They're not going to talk about how it had +13 to its will save. They're going to talk about that little freaking thing shrank me down to the size of a pill beetle and whooped my butt.
So anyway, talking about more things, you've actually, once you pick your special, done with graphs. Yep. The next part is to pick skills. Mm-hmm. So the stat block has skill bonuses associated with the creature based on its role, and each role lists a number of skills that apply to each. It's listed into master skills and mm-hmm. good skills. So if you have a good skill, that's kind of like having half your level and an okay ability modifier on checks with the skill, while master is like having full ranks and a really good ability score mm-hmm. modifier. So if you want to be boss at a skill, you go master, and if you want to be good but not overwhelmingly so at a skill, you go good. And every other skill is just an ability. Mm-hmm. So, James, how many skills does our creature get, and of what kind?
It had one master and two good.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's think. It probably should be pretty good at some or acrobatics, so that it could like sneak around. Definitely needs stealth. I think its best skill should probably be stealth, so it could sneak into Todd's office and shrink him whenever he wants.
Probably also computers as well, so it can get through pads and things that stop it from getting in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so definitely. I think one of the things you could even do is trade a special ability to get more skills, if I remember right. Is that correct?
Yeah. Like, we don't have any spare. We spent two of them just to get the cool strength ability.
So one of the nice things about monster design is that really yourself, having more skills on a combat monster isn't really going to break your game. So if you wanted to make the shrink gun one ability and then make the other ability something that is not combat oriented at all, aka going against its goal, it's probably going to say that it will throw free mechanic, but we'll throw in a free computer skill and an engineering skill on top of its normal master skills. Like, it gets one extra skill and one extra good skill, and in exchange for that kind of poor special ability trade on a combatant character, you also get the awesome shrink, right? Like, that's probably fair. I don't know if Paizo would ever print it like that, but for a home GM wanting to make a really annoying devil, that's probably fair. So the step eight, we're already at step eight. We're moving quickly.
If your
NPC can cast spells, you choose them at step eight. So like you choose your spells known, essentially. We don't have that, do we, James?
Oh, I mean, it's just, no, not for this combatant.
Nope. And so then the final step in making your monster is just checking over to make sure that your final critter has the same abilities that you beginning, that it makes your concept work. Then you go and you cross-check the numbers and you're basically done.
And then there's the unofficial step 10 where you go browsing DeviantArt to get an artist to commission your crazy critter.
Yeah, but they're never going to put that in a core rulebook, Param.
No.
Unless you make it.
I know. Maybe we can say, hey, Liz Quartz, so you can print our micro-sized devil and, I don't know, do it for your Inktober thing. I give up. I'm done.
No, you pay. You don't ask artists to do it for free. You pay them. You pay them the $30, $50, $80 to make your critter.
Depending on what you wanted, probably somewhere between 50 and 100 if you get a really not Paizo level but good artist. Like I could imagine a Paizo artist doing things like that for probably like 200-250. That's my rough guesstimate of how much a piece of art of Paizo, like 1/4 page character art, probably costs in that ballpark.
It wouldn't have to be a very big picture for this devil either.
Well, I mean, like you would want it to be big enough that you could have a little itty bitty devil and then have a picture of his victim, because that would be hilarious.
Enhance the show texture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, basically, like that's the point of having a monster like this. You don't just want to show the monster. You want to show what it can do. That's why sometimes when you flip through these rulebooks, the art includes like things happening to critters, like the assembly ooze turning an android into helmets. Like that so much better captures that critter than just having another gelatinous cube. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, aside from that, after that one page of like how to do it, the rest of the book is pretty much tables, it's graphs, it's cool pieces of art here and there, subtypes, special rules. It's pretty straightforward. Like it's basically pick the things you want at that point. It's pretty
just
cool.
A bunch of cool nerd stuff.
Yeah.
It talks about abilities that you can get for free. Like some special abilities aren't major enough to count. Number of special abilities. Examples include non-standard modes of movement or certain senses. And like there's a list about things you can just free. You can also get weaknesses for free if you want. It's great. It's like taking an ability score penalty in the Starfinder core rulebook. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like it says like, hey, if you want a creature, if it has lots of really powerful abilities, you might want to give this while you're like we had mentioned earlier. Like the art of monster design is in special abilities. It's not in following the paint by numbers. The paint by numbers is much easier in Starfinder than it is in Path.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So with that done, I claim the summon monsters chat.
I already have the page open.
You're up.
I have the page open too. It's the monster summoner codex rule. The monster summoner's handbook rule. That's basically what it is. If you own Monster Summoner's Handbook, you know what this system is. Basically,
but how about our audience that don't know?
I'm about to tell them, Param.
Go for it.
Break it down, y'all. So basically, I'm sorry. Summon Creature, it's called. It's not Summon Monster, Summon Nature's Ally. It's just Summon Creature. It's a variable level spell that ranges from 1st to 6th. It's on both class spell lists, Technomancer and Mystic. This already makes it really good for spellcasters, because Technomancers did not have a whole lot of variable level spells, period. Mystics don't have many spells that are not mind-affecting, that are you can do things to enemies. So this is a good spell that fills in a lot of gaps for both classes.
Yes.
First of all, this spell, unlike the Pathfinder summons, has a medium range, 100 feet plus 10 feet per level. So if you would like to summon your devil a football field away, pop, it's there. If you liked summoner spells, sorry, it's one round per level, no minutes. But how it works is that whenever you learn a new spell, you pick two creatures. Got it, you get two. Uno, dos. And then from there, each level of spell from 1 to 6 is basically associated with a graft. And the graft works kind of like that cool table that I mentioned in the Monster Summoner's Handbook, where you have all these stats for the monster pre-made. Same thing here. All the stats for the monsters are pre-made. And you just take a graft that literally there are summon grafts for like a whole bunch of different types of critters, and you just slap it onto those wonderful summon monster scaffolds, essentially, and you're done. It's awesome. But do you know what also was really cool about this? In addition, like, there are tons of classic Pathfinder monsters that have subtypes in this book that don't actually have any creatures associated with them. And they all have summons. So even though there's no Aeons in this book, mm-hmm. this book lets you summon Aeons for the first time ever. This book lets you summon Agathians, even though there are no space Agathians in this book. This book lets you summon daemons, and devils, and demons, and archons, and first world beasts, and robots, and inevitables, and creatures from the plane of shadow. Like, the list is great. Like, I fully expect this to be something we see more of as time goes on. And let's be honest, because you are limited types of creatures you can summon, this version of the spell averts a problem that the 3.5 version of Summon Monster had, which was every time a new book comes out, your spell gets better.
Right.
This doesn't have that problem.
Until it hits the Eagle Apex.
I mean, yes, it hits the Eagle Apex. It's great. You can have First World Eagles. You can have Devil Eagles. You can have Robot Eagles, because this lets you build your own summons to a certain extent, which means you aren't necessarily limited by what a bestiary says you can summon. You're really just limited by the abilities that your graft can have. And so, in some ways, this is much less powerful than the Pathfinder version. Summon monster, you are not going to have a billion types of critters. It is a tactical choice. You are probably going to want to pick new ones as you. However, the flavor, the ability to say, I am a summoner of X, is so much better for this.
Yes.
It's so cool. And like, on top of that, some types of critters are only summonable by specific types of summoners, like people who can cast the spell. For example, technomancers can't summon first world beasts. They can't summon monsters from the nature-y first world. But mystics can't summon robots. That's on the technomancer mm-hmm. list. And if you want to summon most outsiders, you need to have a similar alignment to that outsider. Like, if you want to summon an Agathian, you can't be. If you want to summon a devil, you can't be chaotic. And can't be. Like, it works really well. It is I am gushing at this point, but I think that, like, this, in terms of a player system that not only gives players agency, but also keeps that agency in check so that it's balanced, this is a beautiful piece of work.
You know what reminds me a lot of? It reminds me a lot of the Eidolon system from the Unchained Eidolons.
Yes, it is very similar to the Unchained.
There, it is worth pointing out that on each stat, in each level of the table of the list, there are one or two, or on most of them, there are one or two very specific creatures that uses very specific stats out of this book instead. For instance, the Skindermander Whelp can be summoned just using its stat block and not modifying the elemental. And ditto for the Han. If you want to summon a Han, you can just summon a Han and just flip to the Han page. There's not very many of those. Most of it is the build your own monster version of it, but there are a couple. I like this because, not because of everything you just said, which is true, and I also like it for all of that. I also like this because it's so much easier for a new player to grasp this version of summoning critters and having stat blocks ready for this version than it is in the Pathfinder version, where I've had to resort to, in part of my GM kit, I have a stack of summon monster cards that I bought off DriveThruRPG that I carry around in a giant rubber band. And every time a player hesitates and says, I summon blank, and I'm like, okay, do you have the stat block for blank? And they say no, I throw it at them.
No, that's good. You're a hero. I mean, like, there's really, like, summon monster, the way that it just is in Pathfinder, there's an optimal choice at each level. So you're not getting much variance. Mm-hmm. This opens it up so much, and it's so easy. If you don't have a cards beforehand, don't let somebody play it. Make them either delay, or make them wait, or do something else until they can write that down.
Indeed.
And that's the rule for Pathfinder Society. You have to have your summon critter ready to go for the thing.
Yes.
Yeah, this isn't a research session. It's a game.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So with that, there's only two more parts of this book.
And you've
there are the
completely.
Oh.
Sorry.
How about now? Can you see me? Can you hear me now?
The thing is you need to lower your volume a little bit. Your peaking is what's cutting you off.
All right. So another... the last two things in this book that really need to be are simple templates. The list of simple template graphs is in the third appendix of this book. It's a lot better than anything that's ever appeared in a past bestiary. Bestiaries tend to have the same like five or six. This one has pretty much all the standards. There's a simple template for each alignment, like celestial, fiendish, axiomatic. There is every simple template from the Monster Summoner's Handbook, which includes things like aerial, electric, there's fiery, aqueous, all that good stuff.
Two-headed.
There's also a lot of custom ones, like two-headed. There's cybernetic. There's the miniature that we talked about. There's Fenric, if you want to have psychic mental powers. There's Umbral Lodge. There's Synthetic. Like, it's really good. Really good, really solid list. Awesome. Like, it feels like someone was like, hey, I know all of these cool different templates that we've put out for Pathfinder. Let's see what we can do with them for Starfinder.
Yeah.
And then the last section of this book is the Universal Creature Rules, which... basically, so they're not all direct translations from Pathfinder, but if you've read that section of the Path Core rulebook, it's basically the same, except it uses Starfinder headings, so it's much, much easier to read and reference because it's paragraphs, it's like distinct sections.
Yeah, they got bullet points for every ability, and like this is a distinct thing. This is a distinct thing. This is a distinct thing. Instead of a big paragraph that mashes it all together.
Yes, it's good, very good. I mean, like I don't know if I can actually give any action that beside that, other than like to start talking about it. A couple of changes that I do like, they changed all around vision to just unflankable. I think that's way easier to remember and to decode as for a new player. What would you guys think?
Yeah.
I laughed that Whirlwind is still like half a page long. I don't think
Vortex,
you can...
just
what can you do?
I don't think those can ever really be simplified because they involve three-dimensional space. But yes, I like it. Overall, this book is a book that really, it impressed me. Like, there are some nitpicks that I have with it, but overall, like, this feels like a good growth on 3.5's monster designing system. What did you guys think?
Oh, absolutely.
I do like, and I double-checked it just to make sure that I'm not crazy, because I've always heard different rules for this. Starfinder... specifically declares when gaze works.
Does it really?
Yeah. It says at the beginning of, I believe, a player's turn. I just had it up.
Each opponent within the gaze listed range must be saving throughout the beginning of... my gosh!
And can you read it, James? Because our audience didn't hear Alex.
No, he was so excited he blew out his mic there. But opponents that look at a creature with a gaze ability are in danger of being charmed or paralyzed or being turned to stone. Each opponent within gaze listed range must attempt the saving throw, will or fortitude usually, at the beginning of its turn. You gaze, get the penalty for looking at it.
The gaze rules in Pathfinder actually don't tell the save happens or how it happens. Like, this makes it clear that it's not an action. They just... it just...
a penalty you get for, you know, looking at the pretty lady or the Medusa. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The very pretty lady.
Or the basilisk.
Or the very
very pretty basilisk.
Absolutely. Okay, so I think the last thing we need to do before we wrap up this review and give our final thoughts on the book is just call out some monsters that were some of your favorites and why. There's one monster we have to talk about because I'm pretty sure it's going to be the mascot.
Let's just get the Skittermander out of the way.
All we got to do that one. The Skittermander. Oh,
it sounds like something that would be like a horrifying pulp-like creature with that name. Like, the Skittermander comes and takes your children at night.
So, I mean, can we all agree that they're basically Stitch from Lilo and Stitch?
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They look like Stitch. They've got, like, I think it's 6 arms and 2 legs. They don't have the little antenna, but they're cute and fluffy. They come in the most crazy neon colors imaginable. They're playable. They are basically Stitch. So they come in a variety of shapes and sizes.
Have they already commissioned Diamond to make the plush of the Skittermander, you think? Or is that something that they're going to work on now that the launch is taken care of?
I think that, like, it's going to be kind of like a hero sort of thing where, like, once Diamond realizes, oh man, Starfinder blew up, we better make stuff. I wouldn't be surprised. I just pray to gosh that they only make the plushies adult Skittermanders and not
no, baby Skittermanders. No, they've got to make the one with the weird little worm coming out.
Oh yeah,
no, that's not a weird little worm.
That's its mouth.
Yeah, that's its
second mouth.
Yeah, so Skittermanders are small creatures. They're about the size of a Yosoki, and basically when they're born, they look like smaller versions of themselves, but they have this, like, naval mouth. Think of it like a chest burster from Alien, except it's part of their body. And so they actually, like, stick this mouth out and leech onto another creature and just feed off of its blood. They're basically a mosquito in that form.
That's what a fetus does with an umbilical cord.
Yeah, they just take their umbilical cord and they take from other creatures. And, like, in the context of their world, it talks about how, like, there's this one type of beast that, like, is so big that it doesn't necessarily notice. And, like, the mouth secretes, like, this almost, like, neurotoxin kind of thing that makes it so that you don't feel, like, the bite and the pain of getting your blood sucked out.
Like so
it just, yeah, it just latches onto you and stays there. And apparently, if you get enough Skittermanders on a monster, they can just suck a thing dry like leeches. It's great.
Like Sturges.
And yeah. It also mentions that the babies sometimes move around in this swarm that just devours everything.
Yeah. So, can we also point out for the fact that this is a plant whose infantile form actually has statistics? Like, yes. That is mind-blowing to me. Like, they are CR-1/3. These are technically babies. Like, and there's technically a baby that grows up into a sentient race, and they're treated as a monster that can kill you.
Mm. Yeah. I dread to see a Skittermander's baby swarm, because then there's also, like it's this horrible thing, and then you get the player morality of, but we can't kill it, it's a baby.
Yeah. Also,
but you need your blood.
Yeah.
You do.
Also, like we mentioned, they are playable. Which is great. They have a list of racial traits that is actually... They get dex and charisma as bonus stats. They take a penalty to int. They get 2 hit points as their starting number, just like Yosoki. They're small. They get a +2 bonus on grapple combat maneuvers. They're currently the best player race in the game at grapples if you take all of the grappling focus option, which is hilarious. These little itty-bitty guys are great at wrestling you. Awesome.
They just love cuddles.
They are hyperactive. Once per day, they can just take an extra move action during their turn. And if you thought Kathassa were broken for having arms, sit down, because the Skittermanders have 6 arms, and they can hold 6 hands worth of equipment. Granted, that doesn't increase the number of attacks they can make, just like Kathassa's, but yes, they have more arms than the core race that is made to have multiple arms. They also get low light vision, and I like, they're a really quirky, silly, fun race. They're gonna be the Starfinder goblin. They're gonna get out of that role, calling it. And what makes them really great for me, at least, and James and I were talking about, I'll let James take over, but the Skittermanders have this hilarious, like, back and forth interaction with the Vesk.
Yeah, it puts them in as they were invaded by the Vesk, and they just are naturally helpful, so they went, we'll help you just get out of the way.
And we'll help you take over our planet.
If it's just what you need to do, whatever. We'll just help you get it along. And the Vest don't shoot things in the back because they're brave, honorable lizard people. So this pissed them off that these things would just calmly walk away.
Yeah, the vests are like the opposite of Cortez and all the other, like, Spanish conquistadors. Like, if they will not... Like, if someone's not going to fight them, they're not going to fight them. And they were just baffled by the Skittermander's willingness to just let them take over. And I think it reads like the Skittermanders thought that the Vesk were going to leave when they had what they wanted, but the Vesk never did, because what they wanted was to just be in control of the planet. So now the Skittermanders actually are one of the, I guess, the core races of the Veskarium, and it's great.
Yeah, it's Vesk 3 that they're from, and they, like, they use them like, if you've ever seen Rick and Morty, they use them like Meeseeks. Yeah. They give them ambiguous tasks because they will do them unerringly until they get them done. But they have to be ambiguous, because if they're simple, they kind of just go, what else can I do? And if you're just walking by and go, hey, could you go kill that dragon? They go,
okay,
I might be able to.
Or, like, probably way more, like, commonly.
Yeah.
If a Vesk leaves it open, like, the Skittermander goes and they sabotage the starship. And then they go, and the guy who sabotaged them goes, oh man, my starship's just, I need help. And they go, I'll help you. And they completely undo all the sabotage. Yeah. they're a chaotic neutral race that is borderline chaotic good, just because they just want to be helpful, but they don't really care who they help. Like, they just cheerfully like to help people. And so, like, James and I were joking about, like, Skittermanders in clerical jobs at, like, Vesk-run businesses.
Like, trying to get the youth to value baking soda and trying to sell it to teenagers. Like, give a test, give that to a Skittermander.
But, like, can you imagine that? Like, someone goes, oh, man, to me if you just gave me that medicine for my dog free. Okay! Also, I really like how in all the pictures of the Skittermanders, they're all wheelers.
They are one of the three monsters that dominate the cover, so you get to see, yes, like, four or five different Skittermanders on there, and all those lovely hues.
So, one of my favorite monsters in this, I'll take a guess which one it is.
Well, what is it?
Dragonkin.
I was gonna guess.
Alright.
Yeah, Dragonkin. Yeah, but I talked about all of the Skittermanders, so why don't one of you take the next monster for your favorite? Why don't we go with two or three each?
Sure.
With Skittermanders just being like, we can't do this book without talking about
them. Absolutely.
Okay, now, so go ahead. You're up, Param.
My first monster that I really like is the high CR monster in the book.
Uh-huh.
The Kyokor. Or the Kyokor. However you're supposed to say this thing. This thing is just a big old race of space Godzillas. They're a colossus. They're the basic examples of a colossus. They basically destroyed their home planet entirely. They have a special ability that just gives them the ability to ignore the hardness of buildings, so that they can smash very good when they go through a town. It's like calls that out. It says, demolish structures, EX. They ignore hardness of structures and metals unless it's made out of pure adamantine or stronger. So, I mean, and who besides Church of Abadar, or Abadar Incorporated rather, is going to be building adamantine buildings?
And yeah,
and their second ability is the one that really makes it so much more flavorful, and you can just, like, tell they're wearing their inspiration on their sleeves. They enthrall their victims as they destroy the city. If you're anywhere nearby, you have to make will saves, not to just stand there and gawk. Yeah. Oh, awesome. you get to out of the save if they smash you, but only after they make their attack.
Yeah, they kind of look like the beast from the Drift from Pacific Rim.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. Pacific Rim 2, I'm really hype. I want to play that in Starfinder.
It's also great because they can also sense large groups of people. Mm-hmm. Because they are Godzillas.
All right, James, what's one of your favorites?
But wait, Param, huh? You didn't talk about how you could wear them.
Oh, yeah. The player rules for that is that you can scavenge their scales, and there's, like, these different sets of armor you can make out of this. That's, like, really good armor.
Yeah, and there's really good.
Yeah, it's heavy armor that kind of falls into the medium category, speed reduction, but it's, like, it's a little bit better than all of the level of heavy armor in the game. It's legitimately strong armor.
Yeah, but, like, good luck getting some.
I mean, you know, hey, maybe we beat. So, am I right, John? Come, gonna hook us up. Oh, no, I'm sorry. My bad.
Yeah, you're out.
Am I right, Thurston?
Yeah, you kind of popped out there. But I think one of my favorites is the noir, mostly because, oh boy, there's a little Pathfinder reference in this, either unintentional or unintentional. Probably.
Oh no, it's absolutely intentional.
So the noir are a race of minotaur, medium-sized minotaur people. If you've played Pathfinder Society in an earlier season, I think it might be season 3, you get sent on a mission to go help a minotaur that's been trapped in a maze, the Minotaur Prince Noir Spiritskin, who is a white-furred minotaur who is very diplomatic. This race of noir have the same name, and they kind of go those same values. When I saw them at first, I was like, they're kind of just like cow people, whatever, Tauren. But it's like reading that, man, they're cool. Also, they get maze cores, which allows you to combine two items into one and switch their use, and that's awesome.
Yeah. So the Minotaur Prince actually runs from the Salon, the Guide to Absalom book, one of the really early campaign setting books. I am positive that this is intentional. I would not be surprised if Owen himself put the order in for this
race. I'm almost certain I have a recording in the Gen Con seminars where Owen talks about exactly that for that reason.
Yeah, like I am positive.
I'm 99% sure I've listened to him give that speech during one of the seminars.
Definitely. So you're up, Param. What do you want to talk about?
The marooned ones.
You are a sucker for the undead.
Well, I like this one because I like it when a monster is an adventure in a box, and the marooned ones are. The marooned ones are what happens, the kind of undead that raise up, if you get abandoned in space, and you know things are hopeless, and you have that and nothing more to look forward to than this long, slow death where no one can get to you, and you're completely trapped out there. And so you become this undead who's only gets a little bit of pleasure when they trap other people and have their friends abandon them too. So instead of attacking the party, they get when a party comes into a realm where one of the marooned ones are, they try to arrange it so that one of their party gets separated and trapped irrevocably behind, so that the party has to leave them behind and they have to suffer the same slow death fate. And if that wasn't bad enough, they twist that knife a little bit further, because then they get super charismatic and get their old personality back, and they're very sympathetic, and they comfort this one, and they try to make it, and they give them tips on how to survive longer, but never how to get out. Just to prolong that suffering as long as possible and become friends with that person, or at least have that person believe and depend on them until their very last dying breath, when they become another marooned ones, and then they sit in silence, never speaking to each other ever again until they can work together to trap another person and help build that little colony.
God, that's so petty. I like it.
Yeah, it's very petty. I really struggled I'm a sucker for player races, and this race being playable in the book, like, my jaw dropped. And so I'm not going to do the Dragonkin last one. I already spoiled that. So my next one is the Greys. Oh my gosh. I cannot believe that these things are playable. The Greys were in Pathfinder. They're in Bestiary 5. They're little headed gray aliens. That's what they are. They're the classic pulpy gray alien. And they were done really well in Pathfinder, psychic powers. In Starfinder, they're done even better. Mm-hmm. So they get like the special psychic abilities that let them probe minds. They can put people to sleep, them in helplessly in sleep paralysis. They get little needler pistols that are filled with blue Winnis poison that they inject into people so they can use their sleep paralysis on them. If the poison doesn't work, they can cast deep slumber once per day. They can hold paralyzed people with hold person. They can daze them. Just for added meanness, they have detect affliction so that they can do medical autopsies on their victims. Like, they're great. I love them. They get telepathy. They're just They're so cool. And if you play one, you get dark vision and you get once per day mind thrust one and at will daze and telepathic message. And you get their signature ability, which is just to 20% phase out of reality, kind of like a blink sort of ability. And it's just, they are so cool. And like, it talks about how even in like throughout the whole spacefaring galaxy, people thought the Greys were like a myth, like were a conspiracy theory until recently, where their black disc-like ships just started appearing recently out of nowhere. And they start literally like assaulting enemy spaceships so that they can board them and take the people in for their twisted experiments. It's really cool. Oh, they are so cool, and they are so creepy. Oh.
Yeah, and I have some theories about these Greys. First, I think they should have classified them as subtype cryptid. And also, I don't think they're real. I also think that maybe they're just a mental, like so many people believe in it that they exist. And that's why they have the phase out of reality ability.
Well, Param, as you would know if you had watched, every good story is real to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was even redacted when you said the word of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
Conspiracy theory is true.
That's because the player item is memory expunger, and we just used it on the audience.
James, you're up next one. I can't remember what monster I picked.
I know you also like the Astray, but I like the Void Hag. I was never much for hags in Pathfinder because they're kind of disjointed. They're cool enough, especially the ones later in Season 7. But the origins, or the at least the flavor text they get for Void Hags, is really cool, where they make their own shawls, and they have to do all these crazy things, like getting coronal mass injections from a dying star to like finalize these robes that they use as kind of their entry into a coven. And if they lose those, all the other, you know, Void Hags just go, all right, Scram, you're not trustworthy. And they're just so weird because even though they're an evil creature, there's stuff put in there where they don't agree with a lot of other evil creatures. They're kind of capricious in the way that I think the cooler part of hags are in Pathfinder. Also, for some reason, I know they just because it's like a monster, they give them pistols. And I think that's funny. It's like, what is she doing? Turn her on for TV with that? Like, she's a hag.
She need that to serve your spell slots.
It's a hag. You get about 12 seconds of consciousness.
That's true. She does have 3 times per day psychokinetic strangulation.
Yeah, she also can do enervation once per day, inflict pain at will. She has SR, so good luck with that. Doesn't need to breathe. Flies through space. They're just really cool. Really, really cool. Mm-hmm. Bam, you got another one?
Yes, my next monster is the Barakas Angels.
That one's so cool. I almost went with that one.
Yeah.
They're going to be aggressively, lawfully good to you in power armor.
Aggressively, lawfully good
to you. They have a look that reminds me of the Warlords of Draenor Paladin. Mm-hmm. Really like them for that.
Yeah, they look really cool.
Their basic mission statement is technology is going out of hand, and they're there to stop the events when some piece of technology is with so much destructive force is invented or could fall into the wrong hands. And like, you know, it's probably not a good idea if we invent a galaxy killer weapon and just link it a button. They're there to intervene with that. And they're also have a mission to fight the devil hackers, because it specifically calls out the hacker devils, and it's their job to stop them from like ruining all of computers.
That's funny.
What a holy war. What a just and holy war.
Oh man.
Their magic, so, their player item is you can get their magic godly helmet and wear it, and it can either be an augment slot or one of your two magic items, so you can choose which one it is. It just basically gives you detect evil, but Judge Dredd version, so where it scans and just highlights everything that's evil in red.
Yes, but also if you read it, it specifically doesn't work on creatures.
And we lost what Alex said there. It specifically doesn't work on
evil creatures unless they have the evil subtype.
Exactly, yes. Which is what Detect Evil should always be. I wish that would backport. I mean, otherwise they're significantly BA. I mean, they're CR7. They've got like a freaking. They get to choose between either having a sword that is a contained star, or just a gun that shoots that stuff.
That's funny.
I love it. All right, Alex, your last monster.
All right, my last one is Dragonkin. This is hard because my second choice, I'm hoping one of you picks Starship Devil, but he was my honorary mention. So basically, the Dragonkin are exactly as Zenfinder. They're an alien race of dragons that are a little bit more human shaped than dragon shaped, but not a whole lot so. And they bind with humanoids as part of like this sort of like partner bond ability. And why I like them so much. They kind of get this flavor of being Starfinder's Chewbacca, where they just kind of, they're like, oh, we're these cool, weird, exotic dragons bind with these mortals because that's what we do. And so, like, they also get this really interesting connection to the Vesk, where, like, apparently the Vesk have religious beliefs that state that the greatest Vesk warriors that die will reincarnate in heaven in a form that looks suspiciously similar to Dragonkin. And for these creatures to arise somewhere else, the Vesk can't really, like, their traditionalist beliefs, they can't really bring themselves to really, like, savage, they'll ruin some of their own. So, like, it actually says that when the Pact Worlds and the Vescarium were at war, it's not that the Vesk would, like, refuse to fight them, because they would, but they were generally a lot more kind of respectful to Dragonkin than anything else in the entire system, which is just a really cool way to take a new race and build it into the setting a little more with some really interesting implications. They are playable. You can play as a dragon, a Dragonkin specifically, but you can play as it, which is super cool. I am a big fan of playable dragons. So what do you get for playing a dragon? Well, you get a +4 to your strength and a -2 to your dex. You get 6 hit points, also pretty good. You get to be a large dragon type creature with a 10-foot reach. There are a lot of races in this book that are large with reach. It's not that it's rare, it's that after Pathfinder, it's kind of unexpected. So regardless, it's really cool, and it makes sense because this game is built around range combat a little more than melee combat, so it's fine. They can fire a blazing, burning breath weapon. It doesn't deal a ridiculous amount of damage. It's decent third level. They get 1.5 times their character level on it. So it'll hurt, but it's not going to be overwhelming. And your targets get a reflex save for half damage. You can use it as many times as you want, but every time you use it, you have to wait until 10-minute rest to regain stamina points to use it again. So if you recuperate, you can use it again. But if you're going for a long haul, it's pretty much just that one use, and then you got to rest before you get it again. They get low light vision and dark vision. They're immune to sleep. They get the normal dragon bonuses against paralysis. Or actually, I think dragons are usually immune to paralysis, so they just get a bonus against paralysis instead. They can fly, and at 5th level, they can fly, but before 5th level, if they don't end their movement on a space that can support them, they fall. So it's more like double jumps in Super Smash Bros. Is what they get. They get like the Meta Knight version of flying, which I am okay with that. That is cool. And this sounds like a lot of really neat stuff for one race. Like, it really makes you think, wow, would I really want to play like a Kasatha or whatever, or a human over this? But just in case you weren't sure whether or not this was neat, they actually get a special ability called Partner Bond, where they can form a permanent bond with a willing non-Dragonkin creature. And when the bond is initiated, it sticks until the Dragonkin's partner dies. And basically, the Dragonkin gets 100-foot telepathy with that one creature, and can also, when they both roll initiative, the pair uses the higher the two of their roles to determine when both of them act, which is great. It is a race that is not only cool and fun and flavorful and has great visuals, well established in the setting, but that one ability by itself opens up so many neat combos and like just interplayer interactions. Like, it's the kind of thing that I wish teamwork feats did. And wow, I love this race, both from a flavor and a mechanical design standpoint. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I'm done with that. Go, James.
Your passion shows.
Mm-hmm. Passion.
The last monster, I think this is more of a me thing than it being particularly cool, and I think that it's a creature that could stand to see more variants. The Ahav, A-H-A-V. The Ahav is an autonomous, wow, that's a really hard word to say, autonomous robot that is a hunter-killer robot. It's kind of like a Metal Gear, if you've played Metal Gear Solid, of just, I know what my programming is, and my programming is autonomous destroying. Why I really like these is one of the things that bums me out in Pathfinder is that when things are protected, they're often protected by golems. Golems have an inbuilt mechanism that just negates almost half of a party half the time, more than half the time. By these being a thing and being set up, there's also variants for them inside of that own stat block. You have options, besides just the security robots as well, which kind of fit this role, for just getting away from everything that's protected. It's protected by these high magic things or mercenaries. Here's this technological item that can be hurt and damaged, but it's hard as hell. Also, I like robot apocalypses, and this is kind of how you get started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like how their flavor talks about how if like they are robot Mr. Meeseeks, where if they can't do the thing they were programmed to do, the exact words are something like, they enter a cognitive state that in a mortal flesh creature, it would be considered insanity. It's like, oh, that's great.
All out of enemies. There's no way I could be all out of enemies. Things are still walking around.
Yeah. It's like, no enemies detected. Searching for new enemies detected.
it's like the episode of The Simpsons where all the animatronics are just like more kids to entertain, and they trap them in the room. Except, you know, you're a 20-foot tall killing machine with a flamethrower.
They're like the
birthday party.
For about 7 seconds,
and then it'll be a birthday party.
It would be a barbecue at that point.
Oh man, no! It reminds me of like the. From Futurama, the one that dresses up like Santa Claus.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I think it's just robot Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do enjoy these creatures, and it seems like it seems like this could almost be its own subtype of other creatures. Like, they put in other things for its CR, for other variants, for other, like, scenarios. Yeah. But I feel like there could be a bigger array of these, and I would hope to see them, because I think they're really cool. Mm.
Yes, write more. All right, Param, you're up. Final monster, go.
Well, I'm going to save Alex on this one and pick my final monster as the Endbringer Devil.
Yes, the Endbringer!
Also conveniently known as the end boss of any Final Fantasy-style campaign.
Limit break!
The Endbringer Devil is a devil you can summon when you want a particular population center to not exist anymore. And that's what it's good at. It's earned its name. It has two forms. The most important form is it's a starship. So it doesn't... Its starship form engages in starship combat, and you have to fight it with another starship. Its goal in life is to crash into something full of people, kill as many of them as possible, hopefully destroy the thing they crashed into, and then just, like, go back to hell until somebody calls it back again to do that again.
I mean, like, when you put it like that, I kind of wonder why they're devils and not demons. That feels really demon to me, not devil.
No, I mean, so I'm going to make a reference to an anime probably nobody's ever seen. If you've ever seen Al Noah Zero, one of the first parts of the show is a group of people from Mars crash a spaceship into Earth, and then they get out of the spaceship, and then they proceed to liberate the area. That sounds very devil to me.
That's true. It does say, I'm actually reading the thing, it says, when the diabolical general celestial fronts call upon the plane's most fearsome agents to claim strategic strongholds. Some campaigns call for truly terrifying display of force to cow the population. Thus, when the lords of hell seek to make a whole world shudder, this devil is called in. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool.
And if you happen to survive, if like this is why I call it the Final Fantasy boss, because you get the big cool cutscene where it destroys the planet or whatever you failed to destroy it on its way in. It then is stunned for 1d4 rounds. That's important for some reason. And then it just transforms into its terrestrial form, which is equally horrifying. And it just has, it's a CR-19 critter with all the fixins. It's got a carbo cavity. It's got a hellfire glare. Heck, one of its starship abilities is just called Cataclysm.
Yep.
Oh, it's so cool. And I like the ecology or the organization. Solitary assault or invasion, implying that there could be more of these at one than at one time, like between 3 and 12, and that's just a funny way to organize yourself in invasions.
That's a great way to level every city at the same time.
Yeah, you just take out everything. You drop on their farms, you drop on their city centers, and then you like, roll the rubble.
It's like that really meh movie where they come and they mesmerize, they get them all abducted so they can take their brains out and put them into robots. You know, movie I'm talking about?
A Metal Gear game.
I think it was Sky something. Skyline? Sky? I don't know. Maybe someone in chat knows.
Now, before we wrap up, there's a couple of questions we had sent our way, and a couple of important ones is, how do we think this should be implemented for society, this book?
Probably race. Oh. Races released as per race boons, I'd be fine with, or using the retail sales program to check off, you know, to
get incentives. So I would want to, how I would handle a position. I would go ahead and I feel like the way they're set up, Skittermanders are basically core in the Vescarium. So I feel like Skittermanders should probably be made all the way. Not to mention, like, I feel like if you make that race available, there's going to be a huge population of people who are just going to run to society who just want to play the cute little weirdo. And that's really what the race is good at. I think all of the large ones should be boons, 100%. Even my beloved Dragonkin. I don't think Drow should be playable. And I think if anything is a major race in the Pact Worlds, like having the Rimbarians, the Triaxians, not be available just kind of struck me as weird personally. I think that they're the dominant species of their planet. They should probably be always available, especially because that race isn't really overpowered. But for a lot of the weirder stuff, I think boons is good. It would be really fun to have the society be like, we're going to go out there and we're going to make connections with other planets. And because we did, we brought this new race of people coming to our society. That would be pretty cool.
That would be fun. If you've played society, you actually do make first contact with a race, and doing it in that kind of way might be fun.
So you not only that, but one of the faction boons is basically you made first contact with a race. We'll tell you what race that was later when it happens, but if you spend enough fame, you can make a character with it. So I think that maybe having... I feel like Dragonkin would be a really good GM reward for retail support. That would be a really fun one to work for because, you know, they're native to the Pack World, so it makes sense there's a good number of them already available. But it is a race that's more powerful than normal, and I think it would be a good bragging right for a GM. As for the equipment, I feel like the majority of the equipment looks like it's okay for Starfinder Society right off the bat.
Yeah.
But I think that a lot of it could also make, like, some of the angel helmet, that could be really good for convention boons and stuff. Because I think one of the things that the Society doesn't have right now, so the content is so new, there's not a whole lot of stuff that you can give out as for neat perks for doing things to help out. So I think having some of like the weapons and armor, they should be like those items fill important gaps in the item level based weapons and armor system in the game. It would be like saying that that full plate needed a boon to unlock in Pathfinder. Just make that core.
Yeah, but I'm going to be a lot less nuanced because there's such a equipment problem and content problem starvation with Starfinder, and they want to push this as a player book, I think everything that isn't a race should be made immediately legal. Like, just straight up.
You know, yeah.
Make it all, like, is it not a race? It's legal. And I think that for now, they should, just to get the core races a little foothold, should just dole out some of these races as boons. But I think at the 1 year anniversary, kind of like they do when they do the re-race, when they do the 1 year, I think they should make every single race in here with the possibility of maybe not Goblin, because Goblin is a special race in the society programs.
Oh, definitely not Drow. No Drow.
And just
no.
Like, unlock all of them. And then no so far Drow. And the reason I say that is because they've done such a hard pitch that Starfinder is so much about these strange races. This is they're even more important to Starfinder than they are to Pathfinder. And then the cool races that we see in the future can be these first contact scenarios, this all new, strange, and new. But because this is all core and most of this is core worlds, they could go a long way to establish that this is about the full Star Trek or Mos Eisley bar full of critters by just saying, okay, everything in here with a couple of exceptions that you can play, and just like open it all up. And that'll both sell this as a player's book, get the message across that way, and just completely sprinkle like all the tentacles you want across the galaxy.
Yeah, no, and there is, like Alex brought up about things being part of the pack world. The people from Versus are statted up in this, the Verathani, and they're traits are fine. They should. It's weird that they're not playable.
Yeah, most of the races in here are fairly well balanced. I wouldn't have a problem with any of my players picking one of these to play.
Do you think that then there's any reason to wait till next year? Like, because I mean, when you look at the core races, with the exception of the Sheeran and the Vesk, everything is a classic Pathfinder race that we've already seen before. Like, I don't necessarily know that we need to acquaint ourselves with these races is a good reason. Like, humans are humans. Like, they're everywhere.
If it was completely up to me, then no, I think they just unlock this immediately. But I just know that the strategy that they have already established, and the fact that there's already some boons out here makes that outcome unlikely.
Yeah.
The 1 year anniversary would be a perfect time to go ahead. And that's usually when they do add new races to the always available charts.
Yeah. So I, from what I understand, usually they have team of venture officers that get together and discuss like what should be allowed in the society. If I could make an urge, you guys need to remember that like Starfinder isn't Pathfinder. Having things be super humanocentric works for Pathfinder's setting, but in Starfinder setting, humans are homeless. Like, they are on the brink of disappearing from the Pact Worlds, and the emphasis is much more put on having this like alien cast of characters. So when you're trying to decide what to allow, just take the time to remember that like the point of this game is to feel weird and space age and maybe not have a human face at the table. That, and I think that's okay.
Yeah, like, I think they've done a pretty good job of that. What I think would be, I think keeping the ones that feel special for special occasions is fine. What, like things like Formians, I think are a really cool one to put in there, because that is a race that is intrinsically kind of opposed, if not not currently, then historically, to another core race. So having that at the table, I think, is really fun and help builds out that world where not everything happens to humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you get to see other sides from there.
I agree with that. That's a huge issue that Pathfinder has. Like, I know a Pathfinder is humanocentric, but you know, like, to a certain extent, things don't happen to you unless you're born human. Like, I think that having that sort of, there's a history out there that humanity is not a part of is important.
Alright, so let's give our final thoughts on it. And okay.
10 out of 10, must buy. Done.
The only complaint I have about this whole book, I mean, I loved every inch of this book that I got to read of it. The 1 inch, that's my complaint, is like, it's definitely packed, it's high quality, but it's also really a thin book. The page
count
156, we're used to getting 250 some pages of bestiary with 200, 300 monsters. This is a third of that, but a lot more player material. I can kind of like the reduced number to get those two-page spreads. I just wish there was a lot more of it. Like at least go to the 250 pages. But besides the fact that I wish there was more book, the book that is here is amazing and I think should be the template that all future Pathfinder books follow. And Starfinder.
At least for monsters. Yeah. Go ahead, James. You can go.
The book is good. Options to make creatures are robust to make up for lack of creatures. A lot of good backstory, if you condense it into one word. Sending.
Backstory is one word. Yeah, you did it. Oh, that was my favorite thing from that.
I like it. I think I'm going to continue that.
Okay. Let me see. Neat monsters, lots of non-human flavor, rules for summoning and creating monsters are diverse and robust. 10 out of 10 would recommend to all players. Done.
Good one. I will buy a physical copy when they make it in softcover. Otherwise, I'm going to stick to it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. Come on, guys. You can't make me wait forever for the softcover Starfinder books.
I think
books.
They're going to do the softcover so much faster for Starfinder, but I think they want to wait for that one round of errata before they do it.
Oh, yes, definitely. We could use a round of errata.
They should totally wait. This one had a lot less, like this one that you could tell they had the time on because it shows it's a lot more polished than the core rulebook was. But for
they fixed the Sarkeesian error that was in First Contact where they did 1d28 damage.
it was d810 damage.
That's what it was, d810 damage. That's what it was. So they definitely went through and made sure that it wasn't, you didn't have any gaping errors like that.
Yeah. So I don't know. Does chat have? So are we closing this bad boy out?
We haven't seen any questions from chat in a while, so they're very talkative, but not so many unique questions.
We must have done a real good job then. We did it! Oh, so before we go, guess what?
What?
My Soldier Hero Forge mini came in. Look, he's so cool.
Hold it up to the camera as close as you can, and it's not going to focus. But
Let me see if I can get my phone and shine some. So basically, James is going to run Dead Sons for us. And, so I wanted to play a soldier. So I've got a hero. I'm sorry, guys. I tried.
He looks like a Hero Forge soldier.
Hey, look, it's a G.I. Joe.
Yeah, I got a chainsword. There's no sword like chainsword.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's true. I mean, chainsword doesn't ask. It just takes...
I know. I'm really excited. I built my character's personality.
Cut that all off.
I'm sorry. Personality.
We have got to get your audio fix before next episode.
I don't understand what's going on.
I don't know. It's just you. James comes in perfect.
I don't know. I mean, so what I had said was I based my character's personality off of Mikazuki from Iron Blooded.
Oh, well, that's psychotic.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I think I'm going to turn it down a little bit from some of that, but we'll see. I haven't figured out 100%, but I based a lot of him off of that because I think that's a really fun kind of... That's how I would want to go with my gritty space future.
So, Harold Wizard asks, in the future, do you think future class graphs will appear in the book that the new class appears, or in a future... best series style book. If I had to guess, you would get them as they kind of come and they maybe compile them.
I would hope that they would be in future archives personally. It's hard to predict because I don't want to say this like it's a negative. It kind of there isn't a great track record of cool ideas being brought into the future with a lot of Paizo's books, like what was it? Monster Codex had the simple templates for core crit reaches, right?
It was Unchained.
Was it Unchained? I think it was Monster Codex.
They never made it into a book. They never made it into a monster book.
Ah, okay. Then, one of the books had the simple monster templates, and we never really saw any more of those, and I really liked them. Yeah. It's just like, so if anyone from Paizo is listening, like, please continue to do these cool class templates.
Yeah. When we saw they're those great. And the simplified monster stats, I begged. I'm like, this is how all books should be published from now on.
This it made me real excited so about Summon Monster.
And I'm glad that's the way Starfinder went, but, but then there's been two best books since then.
But one thing I will say, I strongly think that if the core rulebook seemed like Paizo learned from 10 years of writing and developing Finder and took their best ideas and put them into that book, I feel the Alien Archive continues and confirms that trend.
Yeah.
Like, again, like, you know, I said, I don't agree with every choice that, you know, was ever made, but I don't think anybody agrees with every choice in a role-playing game. Like, give us a year, I'm sure James will find something he's complaining to me about Starfinder every 10 seconds, and it'll probably be followed up with, this game has too many darn rules.
Laser pistols, laser weapons.
Oh, yeah, that's right, you already have one.
I already have a bugaboo.
Mm-hmm. No, you've already published articles about it, so...
I have. Somebody had a good thing, and maybe it doesn't hurt ghosts. You know, okay, that makes sense, ghosts are ghosts, but...
Now,
I ain't afraid of no ghosts.
Now, we're running up past time, so before we head off, James, you had something very specific you wanted to shout out to.
Oh, yeah, so tonight, I don't have the Twitch stream on me, there is going to be a legitimate giant robot fight. I don't know, I've been following it since the American company that makes Megabot, tried to find a competitor for their Junkbot, and they started a Kickstarter and got like $1 million to do it about 2 years ago. They were finally able to do it, and Twitch is airing it tonight at 10 o'clock. It's against a Japanese company named Surabashi that decided, sure, we'll get on the giant robot fighting racket. There's probably nobody's going to die in it. What I saw before is mostly range, but they've also done some changes. If anything, it's worth it for the spectacle, and it's free on Twitch. So, giant robot fight. Starfinder's here for real, y'all.
Exactly. Anything you want to shout out to, Alex?
No. I don't have any shout-outs right now. Although, I mentioned the last time we did an episode that Jacob was doing his Super Powered Legends Kickstarter. That just finished. I think it's now officially the highest-grossing Kickstarter of Mutants and Mastermind history. He got, like, $5,000 for his cool setting book.
Awesome.
Like, it's really, that's really good.
Jacob.
Yeah, I got something like $5,000 or $6,000 for the Dynastic Legacies. Like, that's a good amount of money. I'm really excited for him because, like, I got that for Pathfinder. I can't imagine how hard it was to get it for Mutants and Masterminds.
Yeah.
That's a much smaller. Like, it's very impressive.
They must be willing to pay for content.
I know.
And
what about you, Parham? Do you have anything you want to shout out?
I got two things I want to shout out to. The first thing is that we now have a Discord server. If you want to hang out with us and chat with us throughout the week, keep up to date with what we're putting out, give us your opinions and ideas, and kind of help us develop some of this content, join our Discord server. We have a link on the website because it's a bunch of letters and numbers. I'm not going to ramble it off now, but we have a join link that you can get to at nodirectionpodcast.com. It's also on our Facebook page. We will be able to get that information out. It's going to be in the show notes of this episode. Get on that Discord server. They're sharing it in chat. You can chat with us throughout the week. You see what we have a bunch of servers about getting together games and letting us know if there's any news that breaks. If you're a third-party publisher, you can go there and advertise. And what's important about that is it also makes us aware of the products you're putting out, and maybe we're interested in it to look at it. Who knows?
Yep.
Within reason on that caveat.
Yeah. Don't spam. There's rules and stuff. Don't be a jerk. We don't have any published rules other than that one. We hope we never need to, but we do want it to be a safe, inclusive space, so keep in mind, you know what our podcasts are like in some of the social views and community views we have. Please abide by those while you're chatting in our space, but other than that, we really want to hear from you guys, keep in touch with you guys, and just sort of share the hype.
And we are on at like all
of the,
like, you know, it'll be like Anthony's like, oh man, I can't sleep, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm gonna pop on Discord and pop a message in. Like, we're it's pretty cool, I'd say. So check us out, we're there, we live.
Yeah, there's already a whole bunch of you guys on there, and we just throw.
We have like 50 people.
Yeah, check each other out. Y'all are actually pretty cool.
It kind of just like jumped up from nothing in a real big hurry, and we would love to grow that as much as possible. Also, join us on Twitch, nodirectionpodcast.com, facebook.com/nodirection, twitch.tv/nodirection, youtube.com/nodirectionshow if you want to watch our content. Also, we have a bunch of amazing blog content. I don't usually do the blog rundown on No Direction Beyond, but there's some amazing content out there. You need to go check that out. All right, so I think that's it, guys. Go enjoy watching those giant robots. And until next time, go beyond with No Direction.